Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on the treatment of small cell lung cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Dr. Charles Rudin, Ann Chang, and Jacob Sands discuss advancements in chemoimmunotherapy to treat patients with limited or extensive stage small cell lung cancer. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo, Inc. Dr. Chang starts by discussing a case of a patient with limited stage small cell lung cancer.
So I always like to start with a case, and this is my patient, 55-year-old male, with over 50-pack-year tobacco smoking history, and he presented last spring with shortness of breath, chest pain, and cough. And his workup included the CT scan. On the right, you can see a large left hilar mass encasing bronchovascular structures. This was PET positive. EBUS and biopsy of the left hilar mass was positive for small cell lung cancer, and the stations 4R, 11R, 11, and 7 were negative, but the hilar 11L was positive for metastatic small cell. The MRI of the brain was negative. So you diagnosed the patient with limited stage small cell, 3B, T4N1, and RAD-ONC can treat with definitive radiations. So if you have a patient who has a very early stage T1D2, node negative tumor, this is pretty rare, but it does happen. If you have a biopsy showing small cell, you want to make sure that you do mediastinal staging with EBUS. That's usually we do EBUS nowadays, or mediastinoscopy, and the treatment is lobectomy and mediastinal dissection or sampling, followed by adjuvant chemo, and then consideration for postoperative radiation depending on positive margins or if you found lymph nodes that were positive. Now, for those patients who are medically inoperable, they can get SBRT or SABR, and then again followed by adjuvant chemotherapy. And then everybody else should get the conventional RT with chemo, followed by immunotherapy. And this Kaplan-Meier curve shows you those patients with node negative disease, the 1A, 1B2, they do better with surgery. Once you get to stage 3, they do a little worse. So I'm not going to belabor this. This is the old standard of care, chemo radiation, and we know that this is best done concurrently versus sequentially, and the RT we try to start within 30 days of chemo start. And these are the ASTRO clinical practice guidelines, and they do recommend twice daily radiation or once daily radiation. And this comes from, there's a lot of data supporting that. I'm not going to go through it, but here's a table of some of those trials looking at radiation dose. The Teresi et al. Really establishing the 45 BID as superior to daily, and then the CONVERT trial comparing BID to daily radiation and showing no superiority of daily, so still treating the BID radiation as standard of care. And then the CALGB and Groenberg trials. The Groenberg actually showed a higher dose, had a little bit better outcomes, but I think that the standard of care dose is really that 45 gray BID. What do we do nowadays? What are the patterns of practice? If you ask folks, they say that about 60% of radiation oncologists prefer once daily, and they say that their patients, 75%, prefer once daily. And mostly that's just because of logistically easier for the patient, somewhat better tolerated in some ways. But the folks who prefer BID therapy like the shorter treatment duration for the patient as well. Now, moving on to immunotherapy trials in limited stage, here's the whole list. I'm going to focus on the Adriatic and also mention the NRG LU005 trial. So last year, we heard at ASCO that the Adriatic trial was positive, which led to FDA approval. This trial took patients with stage 1 through 3 limited stage that were inoperable with good PS, 0 to 1, who had not progressed, and randomized them to Durva, placebo, or Durva Tremi. They allowed both BID radiation and daily radiation that had to have started no later than the end of cycle 2. And the primary endpoints were shown here for the Durva versus placebo analysis. And I love telling this to my patients. I mean, when for small cell do you get to tell them that there's a benefit of almost 2 years in median overall survival? Hazard ratio of 0.73, really nice separation of the curves. The PFS also showed a 5-month benefit. So this was an overall win and really became the standard of care last year. Of course, whenever we're adding 2 years of consolidation durvalumab, we want to make sure that it's tolerable and that the safety profile is understood. You can see here that most of the most frequent adverse events were all grade 1 and grade 2, blue in for the durva arm and in orange for the placebo arm. And in particular, we were concerned beforehand about the radiation pneumonitis and pneumonitis. We thought maybe that would increase, but really the maximum grade 3/4s were only about 3% in either arm. So really well tolerated. A little bit deeper dive on a few topics for radiation schedule. About 30% received BID radiation, and the OS benefit with Durvo was seen for both the BID and the daily radiation schedules, with a hazard ratio of about 0.7. In the Durva arm, the 3-year overall survival rates were higher with BID, and you can see that there at 65% versus 53% for daily. In terms of the platinum agent, we've always tried to use cisplatin, but some patients can't tolerate it. This certainly made me feel better about using carbo. Actually, the benefit seemed a little more pronounced with carbo, with a hazard ratio of 0.55 for carbo and 0.81 with cisplatin. So this certainly makes me feel better for using carbo, although I haven't really changed to just using carbo. What about PCI? About a little over half of the patients got PCI. This was done prior to the randomization, and the OS benefit with Durva was seen for patients who with and without PCI with a hazard ratio of 0.7 for both. And in the Durva arm, the 3-year overall survival rates were a little bit higher for PCI at 60% than without. It was about 50%. So in conclusion, this really has become the new standard of care for our patients who've not progressed after concurrent chemo radiation.
Next, Dr. Sands presents a case of a patient with extensive stage small cell lung cancer.
But we'll start with a case, 67-year-old woman, history of COPD, presents with symptoms, biopsy confirms extensive stage small cell lung cancer with mets to the liver and supraclavicular nodes. So let's get into this. So first line treatment is pretty established at this point, is essentially chemo, platinum etoposide plus either atezo or durva. I suppose in Power 133 with the atezolizumab was actually specified carbo platinum etoposide. Caspian with durvalumab was either carbo or cisplatin, although personally I don't have strong feelings. In either case, generally I use carboplatin anyway, but I do think first line standard of care certainly needs to incorporate one of these PD-L1 inhibitors, with rare exceptions. Of course, there are some patients are not, where we would not give PD-L1, but that's rare. Here are the outcomes from this. I think essentially I'll just summarize it in saying that these regimens were FDA approved because of a 2 and 2.7 month improvement in the median overall survival. But I'd say the power of these drugs is really noted in the tail of the curves. Charlie highlighted in his talk earlier the threefold increase, essentially, in the 3-year overall survival. We see from the extension study of Empower 133, looking at 5-year, it was 12% 5-year overall survival. And with platinum etoposide alone at the 5-year point, it kind of starts approximating zero. So these drugs work extraordinarily well for a subset of patients. And I have a handful of people that I think may, in fact, be cured of their incurable disease with 7 years or around that of ongoing disease control from the time of their initial diagnosis, and this is really with the checkpoint inhibitors. So a patient completed 4 cycles, tolerated well, now ready to start maintenance therapy. After the 4 cycles, with response or stable disease, what would your choice be? Continue atezo or durva until progression, start maintenance lurbi plus PD-L1 inhibitor, observe off treatment until progression, or offer PCI. Okay, so half and half with either continuing the checkpoint inhibitor alone or the Imforte regimen. Of course, offer PCI at the bottom, not mutually exclusive, but we're doing less and less. So here's Imforte. I'm not going to dive into this too much. Charlie already went through this. I will highlight a couple things about it. One, clearly a positive trial, progression-free survival and overall survival. And similar to what Charlie pointed out, the tail of the curve here on progression-free survival, the curves do come together. I'll just add that right now this data is mature to a median of 15 months. So the tail may evolve, although right now it's a hint of it coming together. You know, the hypothesis is that a PD-L1 inhibitor with lurbinectedin, there will be some synergy to that. And I think there's reason for that in the mechanism of action of lurbinectedin within the tumor microenvironment. But in the end, I think with the results, the conclusion, or the results that would make me conclude, yes, there's true synergy, is if the tail of the curves truly separate out. Right now, on the progression-free survival, we don't really see that. On the overall survival, we do. Now, is that going to hold up? Of course, both of these are still going to evolve further. Now, the data that we see from this, what this slide highlighted in the presentation, is that when you're looking at the median progression-free survival and overall survival, that is not including the 3.2-month median time frame of induction. So median overall survival with lurbinectedin was 13.2 months from randomization, so essentially 16.4 months from initiation. As compares to the 10.6 with Atezo or 13.8 if you're adding in the induction time frame. We did lose 27% of patients from initial enrollment to the time of randomization post-induction, which is also something to take into account when looking at these data. It's not including those really from the beginning. They had to have tolerated their induction therapy, still had disease response or stable disease, still have good cell counts and functional status. And really many of the studies that we're discussing are like that. In the adjuvant setting, we see post-chemotherapy, then at the start of immunotherapy. These are patients that have been through some degree of therapy before they're randomized. As far as safety summary, there was nothing surprising in here. We see the lurbinectedin toxicity profile and essentially looked similar. The one thing to highlight in this is that actually the neutropenia was less than what we saw in the prior lurbinectedin study that led to the approval in the second line setting, and that is almost certainly because of using prophylaxis in this study, whereas that initial basket trial did not allow for primary prophylaxis. As far as PCI, as I mentioned, we're really starting to lean away from this more. We see the study on the left showing a survival advantage to PCI. Now, this and other studies were done before the time of MRI brain being done at baseline. So there was no MRI brain at the baseline for that study, and very likely they're treating actually active disease that may have been noted on MRI. On the right side, you see publication from 2017. This was done in Japan. And this group, in this study, patients got an MRI brain at baseline and then were randomized to PCI or Q3-month MRI brain observation. And if anything, you see a survival trend in favor of the observation. And so because of that, there's less and less. Of course, there are ongoing studies. The MAVERICK trial, as was highlighted already, is being done in limited stage and extensive stage. Hopefully we'll see some data from that soon as well. So patient progressed after 5 months from last cycle of platinum etoposide, has an ECOG performance status of 1. And so first, this is a table, actually, I show the fellows often. So I think it really highlights second line small cell lung cancer. Those might be difficult to see on the board there. So I'll just highlight essentially, it shows, now this was FDA approved as a single arm study with a response rate of 35% and a median progression free survival of 3.5 months. Those are not inspiring numbers, I know, but it did represent a step forward even with those numbers. From a toxicity standpoint, I think lurbinectedin is often a little better tolerated. But the reason I often show this to the fellows is that the middle column is those with a chemotherapy-free interval of less than 90 days, and on the right is the more than 90 days. And you see a distinct difference between those two arms, really highlighting that platinum sensitivity is, in fact, cytotoxic sensitivity. There's also a row, which, you know, you can pull the publication maybe to see it, but the six-month disease control rate is right here. This was 33% in all patients. It was 19% in those with a chemotherapy-free interval of less than 90 days, which is not a lot, but it is actually... those patients are essentially having disease control as long, if not longer, from their second line cytotoxic as they got from their first line, which is meaningful. 44% of patients in the longer chemotherapy free interval having disease control at 90 days. Now, tarlatamab in Delphi 301, this was a single arm study, you can see showed a median progression free survival of 4.3 months. But there's a tail of the curve that really holds up out there and some a population that's getting real durability. The patients enrolled to this study were third line and beyond. This is essentially a single arm study, enrolled two different dose levels of tarlatamab. Median overall survival was 15.2 months. And what you'll see from the bottom there is that the chemotherapy free interval actually did not impact, the chemotherapy free interval from the first line therapy did not actually impact overall survival outcomes in this third line study, which for any cytotoxic study, we would generally see those stratify out. And I think this represents a drug of a new paradigm now within the second line and beyond in small cell lung cancer. Although this trial enrolled in the third line and beyond, it was FDA approved in the second line. From a safety profile, there are certainly some things to talk about. Cytokine release syndrome is the most common. About 50% of patients have cytokine release syndrome. It was 53% in that Delphi 301 study. In the randomized trial, also about 50%. The number of patients with a grade 1 was a bit... So in the Delphi 301, about 60% of those who had CRS, so half of patients had CRS, about 60% of those were just a grade 1, meaning they got Tylenol and that's it. In and then the other 23% overall had a grade 2, meaning they got some hypoxia, hypotension. That's treated with oxygen, with IV fluids, steroids, and consider tocilizumab. In the randomized trial, Delphi 304, we actually saw more grade 1 and less grade 2 with a similar overall CRS. And I think part of that is just increased experience. When I have a patient with, especially at the very beginning, before we really knew much about these drugs, someone with a baseline kind of lowish blood pressure, and now in the middle of the night when the blood pressure is checked, it's a bit lower further, is that a grade 2 CRS or is this just kind of normal variation of their blood pressure? I would err on the side of calling at a grade 2 and treating that with steroids. At this point, I'm a bit more comfortable with it and don't necessarily rush to give steroids unless it's a true CRS. So systolic blood pressure baseline of 132 and now it's 88. Okay, that's real. Someone who has a baseline blood pressure of 98, now it's 88. Is that real? If they feel fine, that's harder to say. Now, in Delphi 304, the randomized trial, we saw 6% ICANS, 15% in the single arm. ICANS essentially being delirium, confusion, weakness. I know these are more than you can read right here, but there's a publication that has these tables in Cancer, and I was the first author to that. Tawfiq Awani-Koko was a senior, and that offers a table that hopefully makes managing that easier. This is the first of multiple T-cell engagers, and I know Charlie highlighted that as well, so I'll just point out that there's some durability to these, and they've actually looked at beyond small cell lung cancer as well. So the top right there is other neuroendocrine neoplasms, bottom right is prostate cancer, and you know, this has led to great interest in DLL3 directed therapies within the neuroendocrine space. Here's obrixtamig. The waterfall plot on the right is all patients. On the left there is large cell neuroendocrine, low numbers, but 70% response rate. There's also a DLL3 CAR-T. The first four dose levels were presented at ASCO. Here's a swimmer's plot from that. I think we're seeing a hint of efficacy from this. That's exciting, but still early. Not a validation, but further dose levels are being enrolled. Now, antibody drug conjugates is a whole other class of drugs that now we're seeing in of course, in non-small cell, but also in small cell lung cancer. And so this is highlighting those there. We'll go through that a little bit. Now, sacituzumab govitecan, a TROP2 antibody drug conjugate. You see the waterfall plot on the right, and on the left, a spider plot with some patients that are having partial responses and with some durability to it. Higher response rates even within B7H3 ADC, ifinatamab deruxtecan on the left there. Top left is the structure of the drug, and then the top right is waterfall plot. And we're seeing response rates of around 60% with ifinatamab deruxtecan. Now, just presented at ESMO was the intracranial data. And actually, the intracranial rate was even a little better. I mean, numerically, a little better than what we saw from systemic responses, which I'm always a little skeptical about. But actually, they had a really nice waterfall plot highlighting systemic and CNS responses. And you can see there are some cases where patients really had nice CNS responses without systemic response rate. So CNS response rate looks in the trial slightly better than systemic response. So at a minimum, looking like good CNS penetration and responses, somewhat comparable with systemic responses. Of course, there are other B7H3 antibody drug conjugates, and we see the HS20093 response rate of 58%. Here's the IDeate-Lung01. This is the ifinatamab deruxtecan study. Here's the waterfall plot in the second and third line, highlighted, the orange being the second line and the blue being third line. And, this is a waterfall plot that maybe not the depth, but in numbers kind of starts looking like targeted therapies. Now, I'd say the drug itself, we're not seeing response rates necessarily like we do in targeted therapies for non-small cell lung cancer, but the number of patients having tumor reduction is impressive. From a toxicity standpoint, there are some real chemotherapy toxicities to discuss, and that's highlighted here. And this is the intracranial efficacy I've kind of discussed, so I'm going to go on. Now, while 201 is another B7H3 antibody drug conjugate, this is still quite early, so still in early development, and there are now combinations of both of these antibody drug conjugates, the ifinatamab deruxtecan, as well as YL201. There are two different studies of these B7H3 ADCs in combination with T-cell engagers. ABBV-706, Charlie already showed, presented by Lauren Byers. This drug has also shown impressive efficacy and tolerability in side effect profile.
In the next segment, Drs. Rudin, Chang, and Sands address audience questions.
Those were both great presentations. Thank you very much. I would really like to open it up for questions from the audience. I scribbled down a number of questions for both speakers in case we need them. But if there are questions from the audience, I would let you all drive. Maybe while people are rushing to the microphones, I'll start out with Anne. So with the surgery issue with really early stage small cell lung cancer, I think one of the questions that comes up is, where's the boundary? Like, if they have an N1 node in the same lobe, are you going to refer that patient for surgery? Does it have to just be a small isolated peripheral nodule? Where do you draw the line? And I know it's a data-free zone, but do you have a sense of where to draw the line?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's typically one that we try to do in a multidisciplinary setting in our tumor board. I think the patient that I talked about who's a small nodule node negative, that's a no-brainer to go for surgery. But if you have a little bit larger tumor, or if you have one lymph node that's positive, what do you do in that case? And I think that I don't think it's necessarily wrong to do a hilar lymph node, but I think it's probably easier just to go for node negative, and that's generally what we do, and then go ahead and do adjuvant therapy afterwards. Whether or not, if you find at time of surgery that lymph nodes were occult positive, and whether or not you consider radiation to those patients, I think that's also a very difficult question. I think if margins are positive, for sure you get postoperative radiation. If the if you have occult disease in the lymph nodes and you've removed them, do you do radiation? I think our radoncs have kind of gone a little bit back and forth, and at this point we don't, and we just follow for, we do adjuvant chemotherapy, but I'd love to hear from both of you guys what your thoughts are.
Well, I'll put in a little plug for Alliance Foundation 61, which is just opening now. This is an adjuvant single-arm study of platinum etoposide and durvalumab that allows for N1 disease, but recognizing not everyone's going to undergo resection for N1. And, you know, that's going to be somewhat patient-specific. I do think that surgery doesn't get discussed enough in patients with very early stage disease, especially I've had a number of cases where the pathology looks like small cell, but then I'm seeing them and I'm like, it hasn't progressed that much. And by undergoing resection, we get the full pathology and it ends up not being small cell lung cancer. And I think this is something that can certainly happen. Whether it end up being an atypical carcinoid or in some cases just not small cell lung cancer. And so I do think surgery is an important consideration for early stage disease. N1, of course, now it comes down to really some of the specifics. With surgical resection, sometimes N1 can be pathologically positive, but pre-surgically, you may not have suspected it. So if there are multiple N1 nodes, then probably not. Yeah. If there's a solitary small node, then surgical staging can, I think, sometimes help too.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think it's important to recognize for all patients who undergo surgery for small cell, it's very important to give adjuvant chemo.
Yeah,
we know that makes a difference. There isn't a randomized trial to support that. There's retrospective data that clearly offers a big difference there. Whether to add IO to that, it's still an open question. I think the study that you mentioned will be an interesting one to look at. We're actually out of time. I have a bunch more questions, but we'll actually have to cut it off. But I'd really like to thank Anne and Jason for excellent talks and for good discussion and for all of you for sticking around. It's a long day, and we really appreciate you hanging out and asking good questions, and enjoy your evening. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.